From KUAR News in Little Rock, this is a look at Arkansas news, politics, and more. Coming up,
a long-awaited highway funding plan for the first time would tap into general revenue.
But there are concerns about how that would impact other funding, with the governor pledging not to raise taxes.
After 2 years, Arkansas's 12-week abortion ban runs out of appeals at the nation's high court.
This week's joint holiday celebration of Martin Luther King Jr. and Robert E. Lee may be among the last.
We'll have comments from the grandson of a man who inspired Dr. King's stance on nonviolence.
I'm Michael Hipling.
I'm Jacob Kaufman.
I'm Sarah Weitz-Kotacek.
I'm Chris Hickey.
That's all coming up on KUAR's Week in Review podcast. Well, as we record this week's program, we've got a few inches of snow on the ground outside, but that won't stop us from getting into the station to bring you our podcast this week. And Jacob, it was a big news week with the governor after a year of talk, a task force looking into this, a lot of study. The governor finally presented his plan for how to address a shortfall in highway funding in Arkansas.
Yeah, and the governor called for $750 million to be spent over a 10-year time period, and he said that the real reason for this is because of a new federal highway law that if the state doesn't sort of match the contribution, they could lose out on $2 billion in federal funds over 10 years. That idea is not so debatable. Everybody pretty much wants to be able to have that federal match to get that federal dollars. But how to pay for this plan, that's up for a lot more scrutiny. And here's the governor, Asa Hutchinson. He was at his conference room announcing the plan. And this would, for the first time ever, open up general revenue in the state to help pay for highways.
That's what I feel pretty good about, actually. That's a barn door that is not sacrosanct. It is the right thing to do, as illustrated by the needs of other states. I think it gives a reason, actually, for a closer bond or relationship and transparency between the legislature and the Highway Commission, which there's the independence, again, that's there. But at the same time, I think it will build a greater partnership between them.
And the governor referenced Representative Joe Jett, who's a chair of a tax committee in the House. He's a rear Democrat. He's from northeast Arkansas in Clay County. And he sort of agreed with the governor, but he interpreted transparency with the highway department in a different way. He kind of said that it would generate some heartburn with legislators since the money's going to come from general revenue, maybe trying to have some say in highway projects for the first time. So general revenue is on the table to pay for highways. The governor very proudly said raising taxes is not on the table.
That means no increase in the gasoline tax, no increase in the diesel tax, no waiver of exemptions. This is no new taxes that are to be considered under this plan.
And the governor's working group on highway funding, which I think Chris covered a little bit, they did suggest perhaps raising some taxes, some diesel taxes on the trucking industry. But Democrat Michael John Gray, he noticed, and he's the Democratic House Minority Leader, that this lack of tax increases, while he didn't outright call for it, he said that the governor could have shown maybe some more leadership that would have amounted to a more long-term solution.
Nobody in the political arena wants to say they advocate a tax increase. Nobody wants to say that, and I respect that. But the governor won with an overwhelming majority. He has been able to get effective legislation through the legislature, and I think we just have to look at not at political expediency, but what's the right thing to do to fund this thing.
Well, Jacob, a few weeks ago, the governor said that he wanted a revenue-neutral plan for highway funding, and it sounds like he's changed his approach, partly, I guess, because of these matching funds from the federal government. It sounds like something similar that might have happened around the private option spending a few this year. Why isn't the governor getting more flack for changing his mind?
He would say that he didn't change his mind. He would say this is revenue neutral. We're not going to increase taxes anywhere else. So basically, the budget will be the same, but they're going to redirect a lot of that money from general revenue to highways. But Michael John Gray would say, well, that doesn't mean there's a neutral effect on all state services, perhaps. Here's some of the details from this plan. The governor, over a course of 5 years, would move $70 million from a vehicle sales tax that right now goes to general revenue to highways. He'd move about $11 million from a diesel tax to highways and about $27 million from central services. But the biggest chunk of this is about $48 million every year, starting in year two at least, will go from surplus money from the general improvement fund to highways for the first time. So the governor will say, and he kind of answered this, he said in the press conference that, well, we're not really going to cut state services. He's confident that even though they're taking that $80 million a year or so from general revenue, it won't really affect anything.
But we've never taken money from general revenue before for highways.
That's true, and the governor, he likes to bring charts and easels with him a lot of times when he makes these big presentations, and he pointed to all of our surrounding states, and every single one of them uses general revenue to some degree to pay for highways, some not very large, but others like Oklahoma apparently spend, according to the governor's numbers, 64% of their general revenue. So some people are worried that could be a dangerous precedent, too.
And Sarah, you've been talking with some people about perhaps the concerns that this could have on other services in the state, that perhaps there is some kind of risk for funding for other programs or things like education.
Education is 45% of the general revenue budget most years. And of course, since 2002, the state's had this Lakeview adequacy standards in place so that education funding is supposed to be the first item that's resolved every budgeting session. And there's a biannual review of the adequacy and whether the state's meeting certain standards. In past years, education advocates have said that lawmakers are slipping in those responsibilities and that the state no longer is meeting the standards of the lawsuit. Facilities is one area of particular concern because Arkansas in 2008 put nearly $500 million in a fund for facilities, and the facilities costs are about $100 million a year expended on districts around the state. That larger fund has now been depleted, so the $100 million figure is going to come out of the general budget also.
And Democratic Minority Leader Michael John Gray, he said that. He also mentioned education. He's also mentioned the long-standing wish of a lot of Democrats to increase pre-K funding in the state. He sees that being increasingly unlikely with these kind of cuts. But the governor would say this can all be worked out by finding so-called efficiencies in existing programs.
I've presented some on the table. As you know, that's a matter of negotiation. And so I've got my ideas on that. And so what I've presented here is not pie in the sky. We're going to come up with efficiency, or we're going to eliminate fraud and abuse in government. That's really important for you to understand. I have a very specific way in which that can be accomplished. In addition to general efficiencies. But this is a matter of negotiation with the legislature as to how to achieve those efficiencies and those savings. So I don't want to lock myself into a non-bargaining position. So I want to let you know I have specifics there. It is doable. I need the cooperation of the legislature. They might come in and say, we don't like your idea, but here's another idea. And if they come up with those savings and it's reasonable, we'll be able to work that out.
So the governor has some sort of plan about what he thinks might actually happen to this general revenue money, but we don't get to know about it yet.
And this now must go before lawmakers during a special session to consider.
Yeah, he said there'll be a special session, and this has been expected for a while. One bit of departure in the news is originally he wanted Medicaid expansion and highways to be in the same special session, probably right before the fiscal session. But now he says he's okay with it being separate. We don't know if the highway funding bill will become before or after the fiscal session, which is expected in the spring. So, but, you know, the solution is probably politically palatable to a lot of the governor's base. There's no new fuel taxes. Americans for Prosperity is very happy about this. The state can still meet their federal highway matching rates. The state highway department is not too upset, although one big difference between the governor's numbers and the governor's working group is the working group asked for $110 million a year for 3 years. The governor is not getting anywhere close to that, about half and less than half for some of those goals. And this is the highway director, Scott Bennett. He said he supports the governor's plan, as does Michael John Gray, even though he's critical of it. But he called this sort of a short-term bill that didn't get everything that he wanted.
I think it's a move toward making sure we take care of what we have before we continue to focus more and more on building and expanding roads.
So perhaps a little bit new mission for the highway department. They're not getting nearly what they asked for. It may be some new political realities, too, with different legislators trying to influence this once very independent commission.
Well, this week we learned the U.S. Supreme Court will not take up Arkansas' appeal of lower court rulings concerning the 12-week abortion ban. Jacob, this was passed in 2013. Senator Jason Raper had pushed for this, and the Attorney General, Leslie Rutledge, has been repeatedly appealing this. And with the Supreme Court refusing to take up this case, pretty much effectively kills this.
Yeah, that's right. And this was passed in 2013. It had to go over the then-Democratic Governor Mike Beebe's veto. He said at the time it was unconstitutional. When it was passed, he questioned whether it was worth Arkansas spending the money to even defend this in court. At the heart of this argument really is the issue of viability for a fetus to live outside of the womb. Since the mid-70s in Roe v. Wade, it's been commonly understood to be about 24 weeks. This law, however, would be just 12 weeks. And I spoke with ACLU Director Rita Sklar, and she says there's been no change in the medical community. This is just politics and a mass desire to really just end abortion.
It's pointless because it's unconstitutional and it costs the taxpayers money. If it's done again, I mean, it would really be downright irresponsible. First of all, I think that a federal judge would throw it out on its ear if it were ever introduced as pointless in light of the Supreme Court ruling.
And I spoke with State Senator Jason Raypert via email, at least. He had pneumonia on the day I called him. And he said medical records do reflect changes, and he argues that the medical community does think the point of viability has changed, though he didn't provide me any specific examples of that. And as far as what he said, he promised he's going to try again in 2017. He's not done, even though it was thrown out by the Supreme Court of the United States. And let me read an excerpt of the email he sent me. He said, quote, "Slavery was not abolished in a single day, and even the Supreme Court once declared it was just," end quote. So he's clearly going to keep on pushing. And Jerry Cox at the Family Council, another Christian rights supporter, he said that it's a way of pushing the needle continuously to make the court keep reexamining this, to keep the issue alive. Maybe there will be a new president one day with a new Supreme Court. So Senator Raper says he'll be back in 2017. He also claimed one small victory from this that was not overturned by any court, and that would require women to hear the fetal heartbeat test results with a doctor. Here's Rita Sklar's answer to this about what she thinks about this. It's a little bit long, but take a listen.
Of course, the part I do find obnoxious is where the woman has to be informed that her fetus has a heartbeat. You know, I don't think there's a woman alive who goes to get an abortion who doesn't know that there is a fetus in there and that she's terminating a pregnancy. All of the bills that have been introduced to make it harder for women to get an abortion that require that they get certain information before they have an abortion are condescending and mean-spirited. They are an attempt to make it harder for women, to make it more humiliating for women, to make it more difficult for the provider in terms of the time it takes them to have somebody give all this information. And it's unnecessary because the legislation and the passage of the bill is a very deceptive process whereby the sponsors say that women need this information. They're not getting it. You know, women are not children. They're not idiots. There is no big bad abortion provider, you know, preying on them saying, you know, we want to end your pregnancy. These are women. They do not want to finish this pregnancy. They want to terminate the pregnancy, and they know what they're doing, and they don't need 24 more hours to think about it. They don't need the state telling them what they need to think about. It's really, nobody would put up with it, frankly, except in this situation, which is so charged.
And Senator Raper's response via email, I asked him about that fetal heartbeat provision. He's very proud that it's in there. He said the reason for it, he kind of agreed with Rita Sklar, saying, well, yeah, the intention is to discourage abortion. He said, quote, "Dehumanizing the life of the unborn child is at the root of legalized abortion. It's proven that when a mother recognizes that life exists within the presence of a beating heart, they will often choose to keep the child." So he would say, yeah, that's exactly what it's designed to do.
And we should note that the Supreme Court's decision to not here, this case comes as this month was the anniversary of the Roe v. Wade decision. And just last weekend, the Arkansas Right to Life organization held a rally at the state capitol, an anti-abortion rally that was reportedly attended by thousands of people, including several public elected officials. And this weekend, the Arkansas Coalition for Reproductive Justice is holding a counter rally at the state capitol.
This week we had a celebration on Monday, the annual federal holiday celebrating Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And in Arkansas, it's also observed jointly as a celebration to the heritage of Robert E. Lee, the Confederate war general. And Chris, we'll get to you in just a minute. You attended one of the events that took place here in Little Rock. But Jacob, the topic here about Dr. King and Robert E. Lee being celebrated together in Arkansas continues to get attention. There have been efforts in the past to separate the two. And Governor Hutchinson, a Republican, has even said himself this week that he does think it's time to separate these two.
It's worth noting that this is not something the governor volunteered or has been promoting. A reporter had asked him during a press conference what he thought about the upcoming holiday, and he reiterated a position that he had given in the last legislative session that didn't really move any legislative votes, it appears. In 2015, in the spring, there were several attempts in state agencies in the House by multiple representatives, one white from a rural area, one black from an urban area, that tried to separate these holidays, even offered a sort of consolation prize to Robert E. Lee supporters by moving him to a new holiday with another Confederate general. That didn't work. It's, you know, it's yet to be seen if the governor wants to really exert any political influence to move this. He said it's mostly symbolic. But I spoke with Representative Bob Ballinger, who's one of those people that really reveres Lee. But he did try to offer one of those compromise bills. But he just said generally that he doesn't think it's worth it.
It may be legitimately really offensive to some people and hurtful. And I don't like people to be uncomfortable or, you know, frustrated or whatever. But at the same time, you know, if you were around the stage, the committee during legislative session last year, it frankly is just not worth that kind of heat to try to fix it.
And in those committee sessions, they are packed with Robert E. Lee supporters. A lot of people are arguing about slavery and calling different people racist based on their opinions. One person called Representative John Walker his colored brother, and the committee chairman found that that was not objectionable to him. So a lot of division was kind of sown during this. But Bob Ballinger said, even though his position maybe didn't change, he did say maybe he learned a little bit.
Did it shift my understanding in it? Maybe not. I mean, it really surprised me that it was such a big deal to so many people. But that shows a little bit of how we are so, I guess, myopic, where we kind of focus on ourselves and sort of superimpose our views on the rest of the world. And so since it was not an issue that I was real passionate about either way, I just really surprised me that so many people were.
And that introspection is exactly what Representative Fred Love, who led one of the failed attempts this last time and plans to do so again in 17, wants. He thinks that even though this is just symbolic in some way and there's other more tangible economic issues the legislature could be focusing on, he says those kind of thoughts are important. Because thinking about race relations is something that a lot of people want to avoid because it's uncomfortable. And he says it's a conversation that needs to happen. He sees it happening elsewhere in the country, but not in Arkansas.
And worth noting that a few groups actually observed the Lee holiday on Monday. The Sons of the Confederacy actually celebrated this on Tuesday, which was January 19th, which was actually Lee's birthday.
And, you know, Arkansas is just one of three states in the country that couples Robert E. Lee with Martin Luther King Jr. Day. There used to be more. Lee's home state of Virginia abandoned the practice in 2000. So Arkansas is becoming a little bit more isolated as this goes. And even Georgia got rid of the saying it explicitly on their state calendar, at least last year.
I found it interesting that Ballinger said he thought he was surprised that he found it was a big deal to so many people. I found it interesting this week. I mean, assuming that given his stature as a public elected official that he reads the daily newspaper, the Arkansas Democrat Gazette this week on Tuesday devoted a entire page to the legacy of Robert E. Lee. And on Monday, which was MLK Day, and on Tuesday, there was no mention of Martin Luther King Jr. In the editorial section.
Well, that's probably to the delight of Tom Byrd, who's the heritage outreach manager for the Arkansas Sons of Confederate Veterans. He had a little bit of a recap email about their events for Robert E. Lee Day that Michael mentioned. And at the end, he said, referring to the governor's comments, he said, quote, there will be no votes for turncoats. So they're ready to come back, I think, too. And they definitely, if they were all the public support in state agencies, pretty much, with rare exception, were people who wanted to keep the holidays together.
Well, Chris, as I mentioned, you covered one of the big events that happened in Little Rock on Monday with the grandson of one of the big peace advocates, one of the people who was an inspiration to Martin Luther King in terms of peaceful resistance.
Yeah, Arun Gandhi, grandson of Mahatma Gandhi, spoke at the Mega King Fest, which was held at the Stevens Center on the UALR campus on Monday. Fairly well attended, hundreds of people there, a lot of school marching bands, a lot of different speakers. There was a prayer breakfast earlier in the day, attended by Governor Asa Hutchinson, Leslie Rutledge, our attorney general, who made comments. There are also some groups that were recognized for their own sort of their efforts to promote civil rights, I guess, or the history of civil rights. There was a group from Harrison, Arkansas, elected officials and others there who have been trying to kind of reverse that city's image of racial hatred as kind of a hotbed for different hate groups in the South. There was a group from Hoxie, Arkansas, a group of about 50 who came to accept a humanitarian award on behalf of this group that was one of the first in Arkansas to integrate the schools after the Brown versus Board of Education Supreme Court decision in 1955. They're actually the third school district to integrate. First was Charleston, Arkansas. Second was Fayetteville, and Hoxie was the third, although it was the first to be met with active resistance by segregationists in the South. I spoke with Ethel Tompkins, who is one of the first black students. She was only about 9 years old at the time to integrate one of the elementary schools as part of this Hoxie 21 group. And they're trying to, right now, construct a replica schoolhouse of the school for African-American children and turn it into a civil rights museum. But she is kind of describing some of the events after July 1955, when the school was, or the school district was first integrated, and how it kind of drew some attention from regional segregationists who came from the outside.
In the magazine article, they showed four little girls, two black and two white, holding hands going across the playground, okay, showing that kids do get along and kids play together. Okay, when that magazine hit the stand, all of the anti-segregation groups, the White Citizens Council, White America, they said that if we allow Hoxie to integrate, people will get the idea that it can be done peacefully. So that's why they came to town to try to break up the integration, which they could not because almost everyone was united. They stayed for a couple of months, and then the rest of it was fought during the court system. So that's why you don't hear about Hoxie, because we didn't have the governor standing in the door. They didn't have to call out the National Guard. No, none of that. We have a better class of citizens than, you know, what they had in other places.
Right. And you think about Little Rock Central High largely overshadows other efforts. But yes, this couple of years before that.
Right. And that was a Life magazine article that she's referring to there. And then, yeah, Arun Gandhi spoke, and he talked about his grandfather's legacy of nonviolent struggles and what that meant. Of course, it was very influential for Martin Luther King and his civil rights activism.
It's important for us to also understand what do we really mean by nonviolence. We talk about nonviolence, we talk about using it effectively, but we have to remember that nonviolence is not a weapon. It is not something that you can use when it's convenient and discard when it is not. You either believe in it or you don't. And if you believe in it, you have to live it and make it a part of your life. Now, I learned this very important lesson from my grandfather when I was living with him as a 12-year-old boy. I lived with him for 2 years, from 12 to 14, the last 2 years of his life. And during that time, he taught me some lessons that made a profound impact on me. And one of the lessons came about through a little pencil, a little 3-inch butt of a pencil became a subject for a major lesson for me. And this happened one day when I was coming back from school, and I had this little pencil in my hand, and I thought to myself, I deserve a better pencil. This is too small for me to use. And without a second thought, I just threw the pencil away because I was so sure that Grandfather would give me a new pencil when I asked him for one. But that evening when I met Grandfather and asked him for a new pencil, instead of giving me one, he subjected me to a lot of questions. He wanted to know how the pencil became small and where did I throw it away and why did I throw it away and on and on and on. And I couldn't understand why he was making such a fuss over a little pencil until he told me to go out and look for it. And I said, you must be joking. He said, you don't expect me to look for a little pencil in the dark? He said, oh yes, I do. Here's a flashlight. And he sent me out with a flashlight to look for this pencil, and I must have spent about 2 hours searching for it. And when I finally found it and brought it to him, he said, now I want you to sit here and learn two very important lessons. The first lesson is that even in the making of a simple thing like a pencil, we use a lot of the world's natural resources. And when we throw them away, we are throwing away the world's natural resources, and that is violence against nature. And the second lesson is that because in an affluent society we can afford to buy all these things in bulk, we overconsume the resources of the world. And because we overconsume them, we are depriving people elsewhere of these resources, and they have to live in poverty, and that is violence against humanity. And that was the first time I realized that all of these little things that we do every day, consciously and unconsciously, the things that we throw away and overconsume and destroy because we have so much of it, that every time we indulge in any of those actions, we are committing violence against nature or against human beings.
Chris, I have a question spurred on by that excerpt. So we hear him saying poverty is violence. Lots of things are violence, not just the things you might traditionally think about, like guns and beating people and things like that. When you're listening to, you know, and looking at all the Arkansas politicians' reactions to King's legacy, everyone wants to claim King's legacy in some way, say they're against oppression, they're for fighting things. I only saw one person, Senator Linda Chesterfield, the state senator from Little Rock, quote the Poor People's Campaign and note that Martin Luther King's struggle at the time of death was not just about, yes, races are equal, yes, peace is good, but it was about things like poverty and that was racism.
Right. And little known is that the March on Washington was called, the official title is called the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, a nod to some economic aspect to King's message, which sometimes gets lost in some of the more idealistic quotations that we see from King and others who like to, you know.
There's some parts about him that everyone can easily rally around, I guess.
Yes, yeah.
Well, as I mentioned at the start of the program, we're here on Friday. Several inches of snow outside here in the Little Rock area. Got anywhere from 4 to 7 inches with more to the east. But anyone get out, have any fun?
I made it to the radio station, but beforehand I built a really terrible snowman that was maybe like a foot and a half high. It was pretty good. No carrots, but I used sticks for all the facial features.
Yeah, with your daughter.
With my daughter, who's 2.5, and she had a good time. I dragged her kicking and screaming back into the house.
Well, great. I guess with that, we're done for the week. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to KUAR's Week in Review podcast. I'm Michael Hiplin.
I'm Jacob Kaufman.
I'm Chris Hickey.
I'm Sarah Weitz-Kotajek.
You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You can also find us online at KUAR.org. Our theme song is by our own Chris Hickey. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.